to kill herself if her daughter didn't do her bidding or disappointed her in some way. Imagine the impact of this on a young child, being made to feel as though your behavior had the power to keep your mother alive or kill her. How often have you heard the phrase, "Please don't do that, it would kill Mom"? This is borderline territory. At our hospital, the psych department calls the more advanced borderlines frequent flyers. Some of them coming to the emergency room more than 200 times per year, saying they feel suicidal. Then once they are admitted, they begin to demand special attention and special meals. Borderlines are masters at engaging in splitting behavior, pitting one person against another. They often have ongoing feelings of emptiness. I've dealt with borderline patients who get pregnant year after year because after the baby is born, they feel empty. In Buddhism, this kind of person has been called a hungry ghost, meaning that they have no inner sense of self. They have an abyss inside that can't be filled, no matter how much you love and attend to them. They have frequent intense displays of anger and are very manipulative. Individuals with histrionic personality disorder also constantly seek attention. They are often excessively emotional, dramatic, or sexually provocative. They often speak dramatically with strong opinions but with no facts to back them up. They're easily influenced by others and have rapidly changing emotions. They have excessive concern about their physical appearance and often think that their relationships are closer than they are. Vampires with narcissistic personality disorder have fantasies about power, success, and attractiveness. They crave fame and recognition. They don't recognize the needs and feelings of others. They feel superior to others and act entitled. They often exaggerate their achievements and talents. I once had an acquaintance whose resume stated that she'd graduated from art school with an MFA, Master of Fine Arts. I happened to know that she'd dropped out of the program in her sophomore year. When I brought this to her attention, she said, "Well, it felt like I had that degree." "Huh?" That'd be like me saying, "Well, it felt like I went to medical school and got an MD. Narcissists require constant praise and admiration. They are often arrogant and they believe that they are special. And they can be unbelievably physically attractive and because of this, tend to get the equivalent of full service at self-service prices wherever they go, especially in their younger days. There's an old adage that states that narcissists don't age well. They have unreasonable expectations of favors and advantages, often taking advantage of others who, depending on their own self-esteem, often feel blessed just to be in the narcissist's presence, at least initially. They also are envious of others or believe that others envy them. Some can be miserly with tight control over budgets. They may also have an inability to discard old or worn-out objects. They can also be morally inflexible. It's interesting to note that the ratio of male to female vampires is about 4 to 1, but fully 20% of all people, male and female, have vampire characteristics or are full-blown cluster Bs. That's 1 in 5 people, and each one of those directly and adversely affects 5 people. That's 60 million people in the U.S. alone. In her book, The Sociopath Next Door, psychologist Martha Stout writes, 1 in 25 ordinary Americans secretly has no conscience and can do anything at all without feeling guilty. That's 100,000 psychopaths in New York City alone. Robert D. Hare, Ph.D., author of Without Conscience, The Disturbing World of the Psychopaths Among Us, has worked in the field of criminal justice and psychopathology for decades and has published dozens of academic articles on the subject. He and his colleagues spent many years developing a highly reliable diagnostic tool called the Psychopathy Checklist for clinicians and researchers, which is now used worldwide to help distinguish with reasonable certainty true psychopaths from those who merely break the rules. He reminds us that most criminals are not psychopaths, but many of the individuals who operate on the shady side of the law but remain out of prison are indeed psychopaths. A major part of Hare's decades of work has been an attempt to identify them. As he writes in Without Conscience, If we can't spot them, we're doomed to be their victims, both as individuals and as a society. Then he gives the all-too-common example of the convicted killer who's released on parole and immediately kills again. Society asks, why was such a person released? In response, Hare writes, their puzzlement would no doubt turn to outrage if they knew that in many cases the offender was a psychopath whose violent recidivism could be predicted if the authorities, including the parole board, had only done their homework. Many psychopaths are white-collar criminals who bilk the public of millions, yet, even once convicted, spend very little time in jail or in changing their ways. This is beautifully articulated by Drs. Paul Babiak and Robert Hare in their book Snakes in Suits, When Psychopaths Go to Work. White-collar psychopaths are the kind of brilliant masterminds who steal the life savings and pension plans of thousands, like the CEOs of Enron, a company that went from being worth billions to declaring bankruptcy overnight, a company that encouraged all of its employees to invest their pension plans in its stock, while the principal masterminds sold theirs and got out with millions before the bottom inevitably fell out. Want to see what this looks like in living color? Watch Alex Gibney's 2005 documentary, Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. Absolutely mesmerizing. Psychopathy in action. It doesn't matter whether someone is a Cluster B vampire or a full-on psychopath. Either way, they are an enormous public health problem that has largely gone undiagnosed and unrecognized by both individuals and society in general, including the mental health profession and the court system. Keep in mind that there's a continuum with Cluster B people, just like people with autism. Some people on the autism scale have a little Asperger's syndrome and are fully capable of living fulfilling and independent lives. On the other end of the spectrum are individuals so disabled they cannot live without full-time care. Likewise, some people have narcissistic traits that you can learn to live with once you recognize the behavior. This is where those inadvertent energy drainers come in. They are just at the very bottom of the spectrum. But as you start moving up the scale, you get to the true vampires, the full-blown psychopaths. The Cluster B designation is useful because there is such wide overlap among all of these characters. You needn't spend any time splitting hairs over these diagnoses. It won't help you. If you're currently in relationship with an energy vampire, I can almost hear you saying, but he means well. He just had a difficult childhood. First of all, this is not always true, and even if it were, most people who grow up in difficult situations do not become energy vampires. The vampire knows exactly how to play the empathy card to keep an empath hooked in. As I noted before, the tendency of an empath is to make excuses for the behavior of a vampire. Instead, what you need to realize is this. What every vampire has in common is covert aggression and manipulation for personal gain. They are fighting for the upper hand, period. End of story. Born this way. Sigmund Freud, the father of modern psychotherapy, suggested that the types of problems we see in Cluster Bs resulted from childhood trauma and the denial of it. But this simply isn't true. Modern brain scanning techniques suggest that many people are simply born this way. In a study published in a 2013 issue of the Journal of Psychiatric Research, a team of German researchers using modern brain scanning technology studied the brains of 34 volunteers, half of whom had been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, NPD. The part of the brain that was examined was the cerebral cortex, the outermost layer of the brain that we associate with the higher social centers in humans. This is the part of the brain that regulates self-awareness, self-determination, and self-control. One particular part of the cerebral cortex is associated with empathy, the part of humans that allows us to feel, both emotionally and logically, what others are feeling. In those with NPD, this part of the cortex differed from those with normal empathy. When compared to people unaffected by NPD, people with NPD had unusual cerebral cortex thinness in the region responsible for empathy. And interestingly, the authors also found that the degree of missing empathy matched the degree of thinness present in that region of the cortex. Functional MRI studies, which were published in 2013 in Frontiers in Neuroscience, have also shown marked abnormalities in psychopaths in a number of brain areas associated with empathy and the ability to care for the well-being of others. A functional MRI study of affective perspective taking in individuals with psychopathy, imagining another in pain, does not evoke empathy. In a 2010 study published in the journal PLOS-1, a team of researchers from the University of Southern California used modern brain scanning technology to examine brain activities in a group of volunteers during specific tests, and also during a period of rest. Though all the volunteers were normal, with no diagnosis of NPD or other mental conditions, they did exhibit varying degrees of NPD traits on standard personality testing. After reviewing the results of the brain scan activity, the authors found that narcissistic traits were linked with unusual levels of activity in a part of the brain associated with self-absorbed thinking. They also found diminished activity in the part of the cerebral cortex associated with impulse control, which would increase the likelihood of poor decision-making in those with higher narcissistic tendencies. Though a vampire might have experienced childhood trauma, that trauma does not explain their lack of compassion and lack of conscience. Most people who've come from traumatic backgrounds have a conscience and behave in ways that exhibit good character, knowing right from wrong. And of course, there are vampires who have grown up in loving homes who still manipulate to get their way. A recent article in The Atlantic titled, "When Your Child is a Psychopath," features an 11-year-old girl and many other examples who was raised by a loving family along with six other siblings. Starting at the age of six, she began fantasizing about killing people, drawing murder weapons, and practicing on her stuffed toys. Soon enough, she tried to strangle her little brother. She is one who will grow up lacking compassion and conscience. In cases like these, the conscience that is supposed to develop around the age of three or so simply doesn't. For example, one of my friends had a terrible experience when she was seven. Her brother, who was nine at the time, locked her in a shed at their house and watched as his friends, who he had lined up for the occasion, raped her. Her mother, who was worried about what the neighbors would think, never validated any of this and refused to punish the brother, thus creating a deep and enduring wound my friend has worked to heal throughout her life. Unfortunately, in traditional psychotherapy, we often use childhood trauma as an excuse for the vampire's current behavior. For example, you might hear, "He's just like that because his mother was an alcoholic, and he is in denial about his pain." The works of George Simon, Jr., Ph.D., author of In Sheep's Clothing, and Sandra L. Brown, M.A., author of Women Who Love Psychopaths, convincingly argue that this is definitely not the case. Dr. Simon illustrates that true denial is quite rare, and it happens as a defense against extreme emotional pain. Here's an example based on Dr. Simon's work. Imagine that you and your loving husband of 40 years are out walking in your neighborhood and having a wonderful day. Both of you are in great health. Then suddenly, your husband collapses from a stroke and is taken to the hospital, where he's put on life support. You go from enjoying a walk with the love of your life to seeing him on life support within a couple of hours. Imagine that the doctors then come in and tell you that the damage to his brain from the stroke is so severe that he's essentially brain dead and he will never wake up and be conscious or able to breathe again. The enormity and suddenness of this loss is so great that you go into denial to protect yourself. You sit with your husband, hold his hand, and talk to him, even though the medical staff tries to convince you that he can't hear you. That is denial. And it's a perfectly reasonable psychological defense in that situation. Now, let's take the case of a class bully who walks down the halls of a school and routinely pushes students back so that they drop their books. The hall monitor calls him out on it, and he looks around and says, "Huh? Like, what do you mean? I didn't do anything." Is that bully in denial? Absolutely not. He knows exactly what he was doing. He just keeps doing it because he's a thrill-seeking individual whose brain empathy circuits aren't very well formed. Once he knows he can't get away with this behavior, the behavior will be extinguished. But as long as he knows that someone is going to think he's deeply wounded and in denial, why stop? He can keep this kind of thing up for a lifetime without consequences, because so many well-meaning empaths will think he just needs more love and understanding. Or what about the abusive spouse who pushes his wife up against a wall or hits her? He excuses his behavior by saying, "She was on my case all day. I finally snapped. I couldn't take it anymore." The abuser knows full well that what he did was wrong. But to avoid the consequences, he puts the blame back on her. She made him do it. That doesn't make any sense. She was not in his brain connecting the motor cortex with the musculature of his arm. In his book, Character Disturbance, The Phenomenon of Our Age, Simon outlines how manipulative characters really work and the way in which we as a society enable them. He points out the misused psychological terms that keep everyone stuck. So acting out really means acting up. Denial is actually lying. Defensive should be replaced with combative or aggressive. And what empathic people call shame is actually a vampire's discomfort for being exposed. In truth, these characters could use a little healthy shame, as in, be ashamed of their behavior, which they are not. What we call passive-aggressive is really covert aggression. Codependence should be replaced with dependence or abuse. What we call help should be replaced with what it really is, chasing or enabling. Supportive therapy, love, and empathy doesn't help them, not a bit. In fact, it makes matters worse. Those who have been led to believe that love and caring will heal everything would do well to remember that even saints, like the famous Padre Pio of Italy, sometimes refused to serve Mass to those who came to see him if he deemed that they weren't worthy. Now, I know what you're thinking. But what about neuroplasticity? Can't they change? We all know that it's possible for the brain to change over time. After all, new studies on neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to change, have shown that learning new things keeps increasing the size and number of cells in our hippocampus, the area of the brain associated with memory. Women in their 70s who consistently try new things like dancing or taking up new physical activities or learning a language have brains that are nearly as sharp as the brain of a 20-year-old. However, neuroplasticity and change are contingent on one thing, willingness. You will never get any sustainable and positive changes in your brain unless you, yourself, are willing to change something. The Cluster B person has to want to change, and the chances of that happening are basically zero. So, yes, it's technically possible, but it is highly, extremely, overwhelmingly, tremendously, crushingly improbable. Remember, they are born this way. Just as you didn't choose to be born as an empath, they didn't choose to be born with their personality. So the goal here isn't to judge them as evil or try to fix them. It is simply to avoid them, or at the very least, set up very healthy boundaries and save yourself. Recognizing a vampire. The first step in saving yourself is seeing the problem, So here are the common characteristics of energy vampires. And remember, this is a continuum. Some people are full-out vampires. Others have certain vampire traits. All of them use manipulation to get their needs met. They are often charming, good-looking, charismatic, and outgoing. They often have hypnotic eyes that draw you in to whatever they are saying. They may hold high positions in government, business, religion, the military, and medicine. Think CEO of a Fortune 500 company or prominent political figure. Charismatic vampires tend to surround themselves with followers who hang on their every word, just like the guru situation I mentioned in the previous chapter. And these minions often do the bidding of the vampire, just like the flying monkeys in The Wizard of Oz. In fact, when you begin to wake up and call the vampire out on his or her behavior, the minions will begin to attack you, and you constantly feel as though you have to defend yourself and get them to listen to your side of the story. This never works, by the way. Just work on yourself. They often have a complete disregard for right and wrong. Character is defined by how you behave when no one is looking. But vampires often commit their biggest crimes when no one is looking, and then turn into model citizens when the camera is on them, like a politician who weeps with compassion on camera, but lines his pockets with taxpayers' money when the cameras aren't rolling. Looking good is one of the most cherished values of a vampire, so confronting any weakness in them or suggesting an area of improvement is often met with stonewalling or rage. Their self-esteem is derived from personal gain outside of themselves, how they look, what kind of house they live in, what kind of car they drive. They can be pathological liars who are often excused by society because they are so good at manipulation. They minimize, "I didn't hit her that hard," outright lie, "I never said that," or tell half-truths, leaving out salient details. These master manipulators are so often enabled by society that they can, quite literally, get away with murder. As Sandra Brown points out, the world appears to be tilted in their favor. They refuse to take responsibility for their behavior. It's always someone else who's doing it to them. In a recent discussion, my friend, clinical psychologist Dr. Bob Palumbo, told me it's very easy to diagnose a borderline. They screw you over, rip you off, commit whatever transgression, and then blame you for it. Bingo. They are predators who prey on empaths by hooking them with sob stories, such as, "My wife had an affair and left me, and now I never see the kids." Vampires are often bored, so they like to keep things stirred up. Hence, they are often very flirtatious, fun, and entertaining. So fun, in fact, that the fear of losing out on all the fun and glamour that surrounds them tends to keep more introverted empaths hooked. Compared to their lives, your own life can seem so ordinary and unexciting. You don't want to lose out. A vampire from my past always started every conversation with, "You won't believe what happened while you were gone." Then she'd launch into a soap opera of drama that was very entertaining indeed. But over time, I saw that this was just her MO for getting narcissistic supply and attention. Once this kind of constant drama had left my life, I reveled in the newfound peace of my existence. In fact, the level of peace was so profound that my business partner and I commented on it regularly for a couple of years, always saying, "Wow, isn't it an incredible relief to not have to deal with all that drama all the time?" One way vampires bring drama into their lives is through health concerns. It's estimated that anywhere from 25 to 30% of the patients in a primary care practice use illness to get their emotional needs met. They have absolutely no interest in getting well because they get so much attention during their doctor visits. Dr. Mario Martinez puts it this way: illnesses are easier to treat than the fear of coming out of the illness and doing what you have to do without the illness. Full-on narcissists can be hypersexual and very good at sex. They are also exquisitely seductive and often very attractive. They are rarely monogamous and often have affairs. and they will, unfortunately, toss you aside in a heartbeat without a second glance when you are no longer providing them with the supply they need. Imagine being married to a vampire for 20-plus years and suddenly waking up to what's been going on and demanding a change. Most likely, you'll be stunned when the person you've loved and sacrificed for, certain that they will eventually change, not only doesn't change, but instead finds a new mate, source of narcissistic supply, within a month or so. This can be devastating to the empath who wonders, did he ever really love me? So when you're looking at your relationships and your interactions with someone whom you suspect to be a vampire, look for the use of three common manipulation tactics. Being aggressive or covertly aggressive to get their own way. The need to always win. They won't take no for an answer, and if you try to resist, they wear you down until you give up. Lies that portray them in the best light, no matter what the situation or their real part in it. Super competitiveness and fighting for the upper hand, making sure to always display their power. No straight answers, even to a simple question. For example, they might answer the question, can I count on you to pick up the groceries tonight with, you know how tired I get after work. Blaming others for their own hurtful actions. Laying on guilt trips in order to make you feel bad. It can be hard to identify your vampire because often you become mired in the day-to-day details of the lies and the guilt trips. You spend your time trying to handle the negative consequences that come at you every day, so you don't have time to see the big picture. But to recognize that someone is a vampire, you often need to take a step back and look at their behavior patterns, not simply behavior incidents. It can be hard to make this shift to reframe your perspective of someone. But 10,000 feet up is sometimes the best place from which to see their true nature. As you fight your natural inclination to stay in a relationship and fix the other person, please do remember that vampires don't have a moral compass or a conscience. They lack true compassion and true remorse. They think they are perfect. They often exhibit vengeful behavior, are frequently angry, lack remorse, and are incapable of intimate relationships. They often exploit others through deceit. I know this is difficult to accept, but they know exactly what they are doing. They are not in denial at all. They are masters at using specific interpersonal maneuvers or tactics to gain advantage over you. Once you recognize how they work, you are far less likely to be victimized by them. Chapter 6. Put Yourself First. In his book, In Sheep's Clothing, Dr. George Simon writes, "The most fundamental rule in human engagement is that the aggressor sets the rules. This is because once attacked, weakened in position, or emotionally on the run, any victim of aggression, including covert aggression, is always scrambling to establish a more favorable balance of power. Or, as the old cliche goes, the best defense is a good offense." So, now that you've learned to recognize your vampire, it's time to get yourself on the offensive, and that's what the rest of this book is about. Tips, techniques, and tactics that will put you in control of your own life and your own relationships. In the case of dealing with an energy vampire, the first thing you have to do is admit that there's a problem. It's often hard for empaths to accept that there are people who aren't filled with love and light. There really are predators who lack character, empathy, and compassion. The sooner you accept this, the safer and happier you'll be. So then, once you've accepted this truth, what do you do to avoid becoming the narcissistic supply for someone? Let's start at the very beginning, recognizing the relationship. Assessing your relationships. To understand if you are in relationship with an energy vampire, there are two things you need to know. One, how to identify an energy vampire, and two, your own likelihood of being in relationship with an energy vampire. In short, you need to know how to correctly assess the character of others and yourself. You must recognize and correctly identify manipulative tactics. You also need to be highly aware of the aspects of your own character that make you vulnerable to manipulation. We covered in depth the tactics and traits of an energy vampire in the previous chapter. So if you need a refresher on that, please go back and listen again. All I'll say here is that there are a couple of phrases you've probably heard that can help you decide if you're dealing with an energy vampire. By their fruits, you shall know them. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. These phrases can help you form an idea about someone's character. Remember, the manipulator is fighting for something. Control, narcissistic supply, attention, status, the upper hand. Don't pay attention to what he or she is saying. Be on the lookout for the tactic that they are using to win. Look at their behavior, not their words. Now we get to the harder part, knowing yourself. If you identified with the discussion of what makes an empath in Chapter 1, then you are well on your way to understanding that you could be in a relationship with an energy vampire. But keep in mind that the most powerful leverage a vampire has is the character of the victim. He knows how she will likely respond to his tactics. So the more you know yourself and your own vulnerabilities, which may be strengths in all other areas of life except with a vampire, the less power energy vampires will have. In addition to the super traits of conscientiousness, loyalty, and the patience of a saint, Sandra Brown has identified a number of character styles that make women more vulnerable to manipulation. While Brown's research and work have focused solely on women, these same traits make men similarly vulnerable. Here are the traits. Extroversion and excitement seeking. Do you find that you often get into relationships with people who are extroverted and exciting? Does the idea of being in a comfortable relationship seem boring to you? Relationship investment. Do you give great emotional, spiritual, physical, and financial investments to all of your relationships, not just your intimate ones? Do you often feel as if you are giving 80% while the other people give only 20%? Attachment. Do you have the capacity for deep emotional bonds? Do you form powerful bonds with people quickly? Do you form bonds that make you feel beholden or desirous to do anything asked by the other people in your relationships? Competitiveness. Are you unlikely to run out on relationships? Do you stand your ground and fight for relationships to continue? Keep in mind, we're not talking about codependence here. Low harm avoidance. Do you assume that you will not get hurt? Do you see others as you see yourself and assume that they feel the same way? Cooperation. Are you the can-do person who rolls up your sleeves enthusiastically when there's a task to be done, with humor and enthusiasm? Are you apt to volunteer to help out? Do you tend to uplift every group you're in? Hyper-empathy. Can you literally feel the feelings of others? Do you cry easily at movies, sad books, Hallmark television ads? Do you work in the healing professions? Responsibility and resourcefulness. Are you the go-to person in your family or at work? The one who holds the tribal memory of the place? The person who remembers where the old contracts are kept and what the minutes of the meeting from 2 years ago said? Do you often end up in leadership roles at home or at work? Self-directed. Are you a self-starter who works well without supervision? Are you highly motivated to learn new things, figure systems out, and solve problems? Overachieving. Have you ever been called an overachiever? Do you find that you usually work harder than others and have a hard time resting and taking care of yourself? Psychologist Dr. George Simon, Jr. has also identified similar qualities that can become vulnerabilities in people at risk for manipulation. Naivete. Do you simply believe that people can't possibly be as cunning, devious, and evil as your gut tells you they are? Do you assume that everyone is working toward the good of others? Conscientiousness. Are you harder on yourself than anyone else? Do you give the manipulator the benefit of the doubt when he hurts you? Are you too willing to blame yourself when the vampire goes on the attack? Low self-esteem and low self-confidence. Do you doubt that your needs and desires are legitimate? Do you have what it takes to face conflicts directly and effectively? Do you back down at the first sign of conflict and concede to the other? Are you easily manipulated by guilt and shame? Intellectualization. Do you always try to understand and explain the behavior of others rationally and logically, and make the mistake of believing that there must be a reason why the manipulator is acting out like he is? Do you get so wrapped up in trying to understand others' points of view that you forget yourself? Do you have trouble accepting the fact that there are people in this world who fight too much and fight underhandedly just to get what they want? Look at yourself. Take a bit of time right now to think about the people in your life and your own character. Put on some soft music, light a candle. Let your mind wander. Go down the list and ask yourself if you can relate to any of the characteristics mentioned above. Answer the questions above as honestly as you can. And remember, many of these characteristics are laudable when it comes to being effective in your life in general. It's just that we don't understand how vampires can be so calculating and predatory. And so we are caught unawares. Look at others. Now that you've checked out your own likelihood for attracting vampires, look at your relationships and make a vampire list. Going back as far as you can remember, write out all the vampires you've encountered. If you're dealing with a vampire currently, chances are good that you've dealt with them throughout your life and that your first vampire was in your family, a parent or grandparent, a brother or sister, an aunt or uncle. Chances are also good that no one else in your family understood how powerfully manipulative these individuals were or how they adversely affected you. Bring a past or present vampire to mind. Relive the moment when you first met them or started to work with them. If you were a child, did you get a stomach ache when they came to the house? Do you remember trying to please them in order to protect yourself? Did they scare you or abuse you in some way? Did you end up giving them your power because nobody told you how to stand up to them? It's very possible that your very first vampire was your mother or father, and that you were raised to be an extension of them. Perhaps they were living their unlived hopes and dreams through you, or that your entire life was devoted to making them look good. As you go down your list of vampires, do you notice how similar they are? Go back and listen to chapter 5. Listen to the characteristics of a vampire. Trust yourself in this exercise, especially if you start talking yourself out of what you know and what you feel. Note that each time you can name a vampire and their tactics, you get closer and closer to dodging them in your day-to-day life. After a while, you'll be able to spot them before you've even had your first interaction with them, and even if they are so charming and clever that they get by your defenses, you'll begin to wake up sooner and sooner. One of my colleagues put it this way. My mother had narcissistic tendencies and was very self-centered. I ended up marrying my mother. That marriage lasted 23 years. Then I got myself into a relationship with a friend who was also a charming and charismatic female vampire. I woke up after 12 years. Then there was a business associate with whom I tried to start a company. That ended after 3 years. At the same time, I began working with a charismatic women's empowerment teacher I saw the light after 5 years, but we didn't have regular contact. Each time, I'm able to spot the vampire tactics sooner and sooner. And each time I trust my gut and exit my pattern of overgiving to them, I congratulate myself. Sometimes I even notice the pattern the very first time I meet them and never get involved at all. Give up on the vampire. Once you've identified that someone is a vampire, there's only one move on the board. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. You must assume that he or she will never change. You must get on with your own life and stop waiting for the day when that potential you see in them becomes a reality. The chances of this happening are basically non-existent, and they won't change unless they are forced to by something as powerful as you giving up on them. I will add this disclaimer. Sandra Brown and Dr. George Simon, both experts in this field of personality disorders, actually disagree about whether or not change is ever possible. Brown has never seen it in her 30 years of working with vampires and their victims. Simon, on the other hand, who has worked with these characters for 25 years, reports that he has occasionally seen someone change. Remember that there's a spectrum of vampires here. Some individuals simply have narcissistic traits. Others are full-blown psychopaths. Those on the milder end of the scale can sometimes change, but as I've mentioned above, they do so only when pressured by external circumstances like the loss of a relationship, status, money, or a job. They must know that they've been boxed into a corner. Their bad behavior has been identified and their tactics no longer work. Simon says that in settings of tough love, in which you keep calling the vampire on their behavior, some may change, but only if they feel enough shame and guilt or threat of loss to make them look in the mirror and actually want to change and be a better person. In my entire career and life so far, I know of only one case where this has happened, and it helped save a marriage. This was not simply because the victim took the vampire back. It was because she was pretty much out the door and gave him an ultimatum. This was the key. She was no longer invested in the marriage or him, one way or another. She had reached that amazing stage known as indifference. And there's no narcissistic supply with indifference. The ball wasn't just not in her court. She'd stepped off the court entirely, leaving him alone with the ball. She told him he had to move out for 3 months, and he had to work with a therapist who specialized in narcissistic personality disorder, meaning a therapist who couldn't be manipulated by his vampire tactics. Because he had a lot to lose, he stuck to the rules. He went to the therapist twice per week, and his behavior changed. Luckily, he was low enough on the narcissist scale to have some conscience and desire to change. But again, I want to state, this is very rare. These incredibly rare instances of change are marked by the energy vampire experiencing contrition. George Simon notes that this is completely different from regret or remorse, which energy vampires may well express. I've told you I'm sorry 100 times. What more do you want from me? Without really changing their behavior. Contrition means to be broken into many pieces. So with genuine contrition, vampires know that the onus is on them to prove they have changed and done everything in their power to become a better person. The bottom line is this. If someone is truly contrite, you won't have to do a thing. They will be responsible for doing everything in their power to change. In other words, the empath doesn't have to find just the right therapist, the right group, the right anything. The ball is solidly in the vampire's court. But as I said, this is extremely rare, so you must proceed on the assumption that your vampire will never change. Put yourself first. Stop waiting for the miracle and get on with your life. Period. End of story. You really have to be done. You can't believe for a single minute that change is possible. this is the only way. Because in the one in a million chance that they will change, it will only happen when you are really done. It's a huge paradox. I hesitated to tell you of this one single case because I feared it would inspire you to push through the pain in hopes of a change and then not do the real work of disengaging. That's not how this works. You must do what is necessary to save yourself. From there, you can decide if you want to put any energy toward this person. The one and only sure move on the board that will help you is to assume that the vampire will never change. You must disconnect as soon and as fully as possible. Like my friend, you want to get to total indifference, which is tough for empaths. Only then will you be in a position to plug energy leaks, restore your health, and call back your power. Focus on you. This chapter is called Put Yourself First because basically everything I'm talking about is focused on doing just that. But that can be hard to do, so I want to address it directly. Which brings me to one of my favorite quotes from Abraham as channeled by Esther Hicks. Quote, you can't get sick enough to help sick people get better. You can't get poor enough to help poor people thrive. End of quote. When we feel it's our job to hang in there and donate our life energy to a bottomless pit in an effort to make them feel better, the only one who ends up suffering is us. It's like the old saying, when you dim your light to please others, the whole world gets darker. So take care of yourself. Trying to never need any attention, affection, or a listening ear doesn't heal anything. In fact, it puts you at risk. You should not spend your entire life helping others at your own expense. You count. Your well-being is a necessary part of the whole, and your well-being influences the whole in a very positive way. If you are constantly sacrificing yourself for the good of others, then who's going to save you? Nobody. If you don't learn how to include yourself, you'll end up in a cycle of coming back and sacrificing your well-being in a misguided attempt to save others. I jokingly tell people that if they don't clean up their difficult relationship with their child, husband, mother, wife, etc., they'll come back as identical twins the next time. Talk about karma. Okay, I'm oversimplifying here. Obviously, the concept of karma is far more complicated than this, but you get the point. It's been estimated that the odds of you being here on this planet as you, at this particular time, when you take into account how many people are on the planet and how many gazillions of sperm never make it to an egg, are 1 in 400 trillion. Take that in. You were meant to be here. It's your job to celebrate your excellence and your unique gifts. It is your job to use your specific talents in service to the world. A world that absolutely must include our own well-being. So you need to put yourself first. Focus on you and your well-being first and foremost. The fulfillment you'll find from doing this will astound and heal you. The only way to heal and become the force of love you were meant to be is to make sure you give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Treat yourself as well as you treat everyone else. Quench your own thirst first before sharing with others. Find the love inside, the kind that never fails you. In order to shift your perspective on yourself, say this out loud every morning before you begin your day. I pledge allegiance to myself and to my soul for which I stand. I honor my goodness, my gifts, and my talents. I commit to remaining loyal to myself from this moment forward for all of my days. I call this a new pledge of allegiance. Mario Martinez calls doing something like this, accepting your greatness with humility. Whatever you call it, this act changes everything. If the pledge here doesn't work for you, make up your own. It's about acknowledging that you matter each and every day. The point is to say it over and over again until it gets into your subconscious. By using it daily, you'll soon start to consciously make choices that honor yourself. Then soon enough, you'll start making those choices without thinking about it. That's when the thought has become a hardwired belief. Yes, putting yourself first can be hard, much harder said than done. But it's worth it. When you begin to do this, you'll feel guilty, guaranteed. When that happens, you must notice the guilt and accept it. This alone takes away some of the power of guilt. I like to do a fun exercise whenever guilt pops up for me. As soon as I feel it, I fully and lovingly say to myself, "Nice going, you're nailing it. No one has ever done guilt better than you're doing it now." Believe it or not, completely accepting your guilt will help you release it much faster than hanging on to it and beating yourself up for it. It is when we resist feeling what we're really feeling that we get stuck. As the saying goes, you've got to feel it to heal it. And though guilt and shame are incredibly painful feelings, they're far better felt and released than left smoldering inside. When you feel shame, guilt, sadness, or any other painful emotion, congratulate yourself. Create boundaries. One of the most powerful tactics you can take to put yourself first is to create boundaries. Boundaries come in all shapes and sizes, from a complete cutoff to a managed minimization. Boundaries are absolutely key to your sanity, particularly if you suspect that your vampire has borderline personality disorder. Obviously, the best thing you can do to avoid being narcissistic supply is to completely cut off communication, end the marriage, break up the relationship, quit the job. But for many of us, this tactic won't work. You can't just walk out on your husband if you have children together. You can't just quit a job if you need money. And what if your vampire is one of your children? In any of these instances, the goal is to figure out how to minimize contact, or at least minimize being taken advantage of, as much as humanly possible. Remember how I told you that at the beginning of my career, the one negative review would haunt me, overtaking the joy that I should have felt from the 200 positive reviews? It would ruin my self-concept and mood for a couple of weeks. Well, I don't have to deal with that anymore because I set a boundary. I decided not to open the mail myself. I had a staff member do it as a self-protective mechanism. And if the criticism were constructive, I'd make needed changes. But quite frankly, I don't remember more than a couple of instances over the years in which the criticism was constructive. Now, with social media, there's almost no way to avoid criticism and negativity, especially if you're putting yourself out there in any significant way. Of course, the more of a public figure you are, the more negativity. I remember watching the 2017 Oscars, in which some of my favorite movie stars read the nasty tweets about themselves from that year right into the camera. It was stunning to see the wonderful Emma Stone read a tweet posted about her that stated, "Emma Stone always looks like a crack whore in every movie she's in." Ouch. So the issue with this is to figure out a strategy to deal with negative reviews and criticism. As I was putting the finishing touches on this book, I did a Facebook Live presentation with a farmer friend of mine who grows antioxidant-rich black currants that I wanted my community to know about. Hundreds of people weighed in from all around the world, many contributing beautifully to the conversation. But there was one comment, a woman who said, "This would work a lot better if you just let him talk. You're taking over the conversation." Sting. There was the splinter again. Of course, this was just her opinion, but it is the one thing I focused on for a while, given my lifelong pattern of trying to please and heal others at the expense of myself. Here's what I now do on social media, and you can figure out what will work in your situation. If someone is snarky or critical, I no longer try to buff them up, send love, or try to explain my position. If the comment is nasty or a put down, I just delete it. If it happens again, I simply press ban user. My community Facebook page is my kingdom, and I am the queen of my own kingdom. Why would I let someone ruin it? I treat it like I treat my house. I wouldn't let anyone pollute it or leave trash lying around my yard, so why would I allow the digital equivalent? There are many opportunities for people to argue and be nasty on social media, but my page is not one of them. There are so many situations in life where you can make a simple change to protect your energy. If there's someone at work you end up chatting with who sucks you dry every time you pass them on your way to the bathroom, find a different route to the bathroom. If there isn't a different route, is there a different bathroom? Does your friend call only when he needs something? Don't answer, but don't make excuses. Behavior is everything. If he ever gets up the courage to ask you if you've been avoiding him, call him out on his behavior. Be prepared for this to not go over well. One of my friends, who I'll call Sandy, works at a company where the general manager is a bully and a vampire. Sandy eventually became sick of the angry outbursts and insults that he had to endure from this guy. He finally said, "What have I ever done to make you treat me this way?" And that was the end of it. Sandy stood up to the bully, and the bully went elsewhere. I recently heard that that same bully went a bit too far and was fired. There's also trouble in his marriage. Pretty standard for your average vampire. The power of no. One of the best ways to minimize your interaction with energy vampires is to become empowered in the negative. In other words, learn how to turn people down, even if you have to hurt them a bit in the process. This is essential. Be like those old drug commercials. Just say no. I know what you're thinking. If saying no were so easy, I would have already started doing it. But here's the thing. Saying no just takes practice. It's possible to say no in a way that doesn't injure the person you're talking to. It's all about compassion, which you have in spades. If no doesn't come easily to you at first, then at least say, "I'll get back to you." The main thing you need to master is to stop the knee-jerk yes. Here's a good way to say no. "I'm so honored that you asked, but I simply must decline. I know you'll understand." Here's a quick exercise that you can use as you start to practice your no. The next time someone asks you to do something, take a breath and tune in to how you are feeling. Does your stomach drop when you think of saying yes? Are you excited? Are you annoyed that they asked? By paying attention to these sensations, you'll know pretty quickly if you actually want to say yes. And if it's not a hell yes, it's a no. If it's a no, always remember that if you say yes when you want to say no, your ambivalence will adversely affect the energy of the entire endeavor. You aren't doing anyone any favors with your yes. Start out saying no on a small scale. Do you want a soda? No. Is it okay for me to throw my coat on your bed? No. Please put it here instead. Is it okay if I eat while we talk? No. Watch how a 2-year-old does it. This is the age at which we naturally develop boundaries and learn the word no. My 2-year-old granddaughter delights me when she doesn't like something I'm doing and says, "Lulu, stop it," loud and clear. Once you get a bit more comfortable saying no, or "I'll get back to you," for the little things, you can move on to the big things. But don't just jump in. Imagine a big situation where you want to say no but haven't had the guts to do it in the past. Walk yourself through it step by step. You might even bring to mind a situation in which you said yes when you meant no. How did it turn out? Did you end up being pleased that you said yes, or, as so often happens, did the situation just get worse and worse? There's no time in the unconscious. When you replay a situation or feeling as though it were happening in the present, it reinforces the situation. Neither the mind nor body knows the difference between the past and the present. They don't know if you are experiencing something in the present moment or in a memory. All they know is that you are experiencing an emotion associated with the situation. That's real enough for the brain to log this as a real experience. And when you do this repeatedly, you grow neural pathways that determine how you will react in your life. So the goal in this visualization is to create a neural